Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Good evening, everyone. Okay, this evening we begin a new sutta. This is discourse number 28 in the Majjhima Nikaya. This is called the Mahahatipadopama Sutta, which means the greater discourse or the longer discourse on the simile of the elephant's footprint. It's because there are two suttas which use the simile of the elephant's footprint already. It's about 2 years ago that we did the shorter one, which is number 27. So now we come to the longer one. Is it longer? I guess when it's really filled out, it must be longer. Okay, and this sutta is spoken not by the Buddha himself, but by the Venerable Sariputta, who, as we know, was the Buddha's chief disciple, and he was the disciple who was most distinguished in the faculty of paññā, or wisdom. Okay, and so the sutta opens at the time the Buddha was living in Jeta's grove at Savatthi. And on this occasion, the Venerable Sariputta starts the discourse by calling the attention of the monks. He says, friends, bhikkhus. Then they reply and say, friend. Okay, then Venerable Sariputta starts with the simile of the footprint. And he says, just as the footprint of any living being that walks can be placed within an elephant's footprint, and so the elephant's footprint is declared the chief of them with respect to its great size. So, he says, all, he uses the expression here, kusala dhamma, can be included in the four noble truths. Now, usually kusala dhamma means wholesome qualities or wholesome mental states. But in the Four Noble Truths, we also have some unwholesome mental states. Like the Second Noble Truth, we have craving, tanha, which is not a wholesome mental state. It's one of the chief unwholesome mental states. And so it seems here that kusala dhamma perhaps doesn't mean wholesome mental qualities, but rather good teachings, wholesome teachings. And also the first noble truth is the noble truth of dukkha, of suffering. That would not be a wholesome mental state. So the only noble truth that actually includes wholesome mental qualities or mental states would be the fourth noble truth, the truth of the path. But we could say that by implication that all of the good teachings of the Buddha are in some way connected, derived from the teaching of the Four Noble Truths. And so for this reason, when the Buddha began his teaching career, he began with the Four Noble Truths. And many of the other teachings that he gave throughout his 45 years ministry are developments, elaborations, offshoots of the Four Noble Truths. And often when we see teachings that superficially don't have any apparent connection with the Four Noble Truths, when we take some of the key terms and we investigate how are these terms to be understood and sort of trace them to their fundamental meaning, we can see that they can fall into the range or be connected with the Four Noble Truths. Last week, if you remember, I did this in explaining that discourse on the great sixfold base. And with the Chachaka Sutta, the six sets of six, the different terms in those two suttas, we can take them and relate them to the Four Noble Truths. Even a teaching like dependent origination, Paticca-samuppada, that is an elaboration of the Second Noble Truth. The different teachings on the five aggregates, the six sense bases, the 18 elements, those are elaborations, more detailed treatments of the First Noble Truth. And we could say that the teachings of different modes of practice, whether it be the four foundations of mindfulness, the five faculties, the seven factors of enlightenment, these are different methods of explaining the Fourth Noble Truth, the way to the cessation of suffering. Okay, so Venerable Sariputta, he makes this opening statement, very powerful statement, that all of the good teachings of the Buddha can be included in the Four Noble Truths just the way the footprint of any other living being that walks, any other animal. We take the footprint of a tiger, footprint of a leopard, the footprint of lion. What are some other big animals? Bears. What do you say? Hippopotamus, that's a big one. They can all fit into the footprint of an elephant. How about the footprint of a whale? No, the whale doesn't walk. Okay, so what are the Four Noble Truths now? The Noble Truth of suffering, the Noble Truth of the origin of suffering, the Noble Truth of the cessation of suffering, and the Noble Truth of the way leading to the cessation of suffering. Now we have to follow the structure of this teaching. This is going to be a very, very clever, almost ingenious way of treating the Four Noble Truths and then drawing out from the Four Noble Truths, let's say cutting out from the Four Noble Truths, cutting the Four Noble Truths into finer and finer slices until we take out from the Four Noble Truths the elements that are going to be used as subjects of meditation. And then Venerable Sariputta is going to build upon each of these four elements, each one individually, a whole comprehensive approach to the development, to the practice of the Buddha's path. Okay, so we begin with the Four Noble Truths. The truth of suffering, its origin, its cessation, and the path to cessation. Okay, now from these four, he takes the noble truth of suffering. What is the noble truth of suffering? Birth, aging, death. Three types of bodily suffering. Sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. Five different aspects of suffering. Not to obtain what one wants. And then in short, the five aggregates subject to clinging are suffering. So the five aggregates, this is a way of summing up the whole significance of the first noble truth, the noble truth of suffering. And the Buddha originally mentions this, but when Sariputta mentions the five aggregates, then he's taking this noble truth of dukkha, of suffering, to a different level. Now, it's not so much suffering as experiences of pain, misery, or sorrow. But now what he's saying is that somehow the whole constitution of experience is in some way bound up with unsatisfactoriness. Well, here I say, in this sense, the word dukkha doesn't really mean suffering in the sense of pain or misery, but it rather means has the sense of being defective, flawed, inadequate. Okay, these five aggregates, what are these five aggregates? These five aggregates, we could say, are the basic constituents, the basic components of experience, the basic factors of experience. We might say that they are the threads that make up the fabric of experience. It's sometimes said in popular books on Buddhism or unpopular books on Buddhism that what the Buddha calls a person is just a collection or compound of the five aggregates. I don't think this is a very satisfactory expression, because when you have something which is a collection or compound, it means you can take five things that can exist independently, and you put them together, and then they exist in this compounded state, and then you can take them apart, and they can also again exist independently when you take them apart. But you can't take these five aggregates apart. I mean, you can analyze them and dissect them intellectually, but you can't take feeling and perception and put them and separate them as though they can exist separately. But they're always interwoven. They're factors that make up experience. So we can just reflectively examine experience and view it from these five different angles. we can see that there are these five different facets, five different dimensions to experience. Okay, and so what are these five aggregates? First, let's take this term. It's interesting to take the whole expression, panchupadana khanda. Okay, at one level, we can translate quite literally this expression, panchupadana khanda. Pancha means five. Upadana means clinging or attachment. And khanda, somebody, early translator, came up with the word aggregates. The commentary, the German translators came up with the word Gruppe, which in English it's the same as group. The five groups. The Pali commentators explain aggregate as rasi, which means heap. But there are some interesting metaphors going on in this, which come out when one understands the way certain Pali words are used throughout the suttas. The word khanda, which is here translated aggregate or group or heap, is often used to mean like a log, like the trunk of a tree, a log, a heap of firewood, a heap of firewood is called a khanda. And the word upadana. And also we have an expression that comes, agikanda, which means a mass of flame, a mass of fire. When there's a big fire, it's called agikanda, a mass of fire. And the word upadana also means fuel. So these five aggregates can be seen as five types of things which serve as fuel, five types of firewood, so to speak, five types of firewood which serve as fuel for sustaining the fires. And what is the fire? There's usually more specific types of fires that are spoken of. Often it's three fires. Who's read the fire sermon? Yeah. Say them. Three? Yeah, right, yeah. They're also called the three fires. The fire of greed, the fire of hatred, the fire of delusion. So I haven't actually seen this stated explicitly in the text that the five aggregates are the fuel for the fire of greed, hatred, and delusion. Well, one might be able to see it in that way. Okay, so what are these five aggregates? These five, now the five aggregates are said to be upadana. That is, in this case, we can see them as fuel for clinging. That these are, these five aggregates, these five aspects of experience are things that one clings to. Whatever one clings to, whatever one holds to, whatever one becomes attached to, falls into one or another of these five groups, these five sets of factors. Okay, and so what are these five factors? We have the material form aggregate affected by clinging, the feeling aggregate affected by clinging, the perception aggregate affected by clinging, the formations aggregate affected by clinging, and the consciousness aggregate affected by clinging. Okay, now we're not going to go into a detailed explanation of these because we come back to them later in the sutta. Then it becomes more interesting when we take it at the end of the sutta. But out of these five aggregates, Sariputta takes just the material form aggregate and he divides or explains the material form aggregate as consisting of the four great elements, and the material form derived from the four great elements. So we have two types or two aspects to the material form aggregate. Material form is bodily form, physical form. The Pali word is very simple, rupa. But in English, we have to, in order to get that sense, we have to use various makeshift renderings. So I use material form or physical form, bodily form. And we have this twofold aspects, two aspects to the material form aggregate. The four great elements or four primary elements, and then there are types of material form that are based on the four primary elements, derived from the four primary elements. Okay, in the suttas, we don't find any explanation of what is actually meant by the material form derived from the four great elements. We just have this expression used, upadhaya rupa. But in the later texts called the Abhidhamma, or system, in the system called the Abhidhamma, an attempt is made to classify different types of material phenomena mentioned in the suttas into this category of the types of form derived from the four great elements. So just a few examples. the five physical sense faculties are included within this derived physical form. I've mentioned in earlier classes that within the sense organs, the five sense organs, in each organ there's a type of subtle form or subtle matter which is especially receptive or specifically receptive to its own type of sense object. In the physical eye, there's a very subtle type of matter which is receptive to light and color. Inside the ear, there is a special type of material substance which is receptive to sounds, and so with each of the other senses. So this type of matter is one of the kinds of derived matter. Also, the sense objects are considered types of derived matter. The objects of sight, sound, the objects of sight, that is color and form, sounds, smells, and tastes. So the object of touch is said to be the great elements themselves. We'll come to that a little bit later. Okay, I don't want to get into an analysis of derived matter, but just to give some examples of types of matter which later texts include within this material form derived from the four great elements. But now we come to the main subject of consideration in this sutta, which are the four great elements themselves. And these are called the earth element, the water element, the fire element, and the air element. Okay, now the Buddha used these expressions that were in common use during the period in which he was teaching. But when we hear these expressions, earth element, water element, fire element, wind element, we shouldn't imagine that the Buddha was simply thinking of these four coarse elements as being the basic building blocks of matter. But rather, he's using these terms of common speech to indicate what we can call, what we might call four behavioral properties of material phenomena, or four different aspects of material phenomena. And at the more philosophical level, it's said that any material phenomena actually is a combination of all four of these aspects. It's just that in one phenomena, a certain aspect dominates over the other aspects. Okay, so what is signified by these four aspects or four elements? The earth element signifies the aspect of solidity. Or we can even say that this is the aspect of resistance, the aspect of matter by which matter occupies space and resists being occupied, by which any physical entity occupies space and resists being pushed away by another entity, by another physical entity. And the earth element becomes known to us, it becomes experienced by us as the degree of hardness or softness of a physical object. And even physical entities that we cannot actually touch and experience, well, let us say that we cannot experience very clearly, like, for example, the air around us also has some degree of earth element or hardness. As the atomic theory of matter will tell us, that the air is made up of atoms, and these atoms occupy space, and that solidity of the atoms, that is the earth element. Okay, the water element, we could say, is the property of fluidity, of flowing, of oozing. And later texts, more philosophical texts, explain the water element as the binding property of matter, the property of cohesion. Probably they came to this conclusion through the experience of seeing how when one adds water to flour, it causes the flour to bind together to form dough. And so from there one can draw the inference that it is by the water that provides that cohesive force that binds the particles of flour together. Also, when one wants to make cement, one adds, to make cement that one can use in construction, one has to add water to the cement powder. Then one will have the liquid cement that can be used for construction. And it's that liquid cement that make that the liquid, one adds the liquid, the water to it, that enables the particles of the cement to hold together, to bind together. And so from this, one might say that the water element, maybe, if one were to use a modern scientific explanation, it might be that electromagnetic binding force between the different subatomic particles, even in an atom, that bind those subatomic particles together. And maybe the force that binds atoms together within a molecule. Okay, the fire element is, we say, the aspect of kinetic energy, of heat energy. And it's said to have the property of maturation or ripening, in that when something is heated, it's found to mature or to ripen more quickly. For example, when we leave fruit out in the open, then it ripens more quickly. If we put it in the refrigerator, then it is preserved longer, fruit and vegetables. This is because when the fruit is exposed to warmth, that warmth promotes the oxidation of the fruit. And so the fruit tends to mature more quickly. I hope there's no scientist out there. Okay, and the fire element is experienced, concretely experienced as heat, and then its relative absence is experienced as cold. And then the air element is the property of pressure, the property of expansion. And it's experienced as, because when air blows, then we feel it as a pressure. We feel the air blowing against us, and we feel that as a pressure. And the air can be experienced, the air element can be experienced as expansion and contraction. This was probably, this observation was made through the experience of breathing. As we breathe in, there's an expansion of the lungs. As we breathe out, there's a contraction. If you blow into a balloon, the balloon will expand. And when the air is released from the balloon, then the balloon contracts. Okay, and so we have these four properties of material phenomena. And according to the Buddha's teaching, these four properties are together in any material phenomena. So even this piece of chalk has the earth element present in its solidity, its hardness. It has the water element in there. There's some liquid in there. There's some water, even though it's not very wet, but it's, there's some water which, if we were to subject it to a high degree of heat, one would find that it's giving off some vapor. And perhaps it's this water which is causing the particles of chalk to bind together. It has some degree of heat. Though the way this monastery was up until this morning, I was thinking that this might be one of the places on earth that doesn't have the heat element till we put the heat up. Okay, but there's some degree of heat. Everything above absolute zero, even this is called carbon dioxide, liquid ice, frozen carbon dioxide, very, very cold, has some degree of heat. And in this piece of chalk also, there is the air element, even though we can't see it, but at some very, very subtle atomic level, molecular level, there'll be expansion and contraction taking place in it. If we had a microscope, a subatomic microscope, electronic microscope, we could see the different particles expanding, contracting, very subtle levels. Okay, but we begin observation at grosser levels, and then we have to work down in our observation to these subtler levels. Okay, and now Venerable Sariputta, now out of the four elements, he first takes the earth element, and he says the earth element may be either internal or external. And you see, I put this dichotomy on the board here. So I just want to sort of retrace this pattern that Sariputta has set up. Okay, he starts with the Four Noble Truths. Out of the Four Noble Truths, he takes the First Noble Truth, and he mentions, I think it's 11 aspects of the Four Noble Truths, 11 types of suffering, or dukkha. Out of those 11 aspects, he just takes the 11th aspect. which is the five clinging aggregates. Out of the five, he mentions the five clinging aggregates. Out of those five, he just takes the aggregate of material form. He divides it into the two types, the four primary elements and the derived material form. Then he takes just the primary types of the four primary elements. Out of the four primary elements, he takes just the earth element. And out of the earth element, he divides it into the two types, internal and external. So everything else he's going to put aside, but eventually he's going to pull everything else together as the sutta goes on. But now he begins by taking the earth element, the internal earth element. And what is meant now by the internal earth element? Here he gives the explanation. Okay, whatever there is internally belonging to oneself that is solid, solidified, and he uses this word, clung to. It really means organic. We could say organic. Then he gives examples. He mentions 20 types of bodily parts in which the earth element is predominant. Okay, what are these 20 parts? Head hairs, body hairs, the fingernails, teeth, skin, the flesh or muscles, the sinews, bones, the bone marrow, kidneys, heart, liver, the diaphragm, spleen, lungs, intestines, mesentery, stomach, feces, or whatever else internally belonging to oneself is solid, solidified, and clung to, or let's say organic. This is called the internal earth element. Okay, so now these are examples of the internal earth element. And when he says whatever else internally belonging to oneself is solid, solidified, and organic, this refers to anything else in the body that has any degree of solidity to it. So even in those parts of the body which are predominantly liquid, for example, the blood is classified as the water element or liquid element, because it's liquid. But in the blood, there's solidity. Because now we know that the blood is made up of blood cells within a plasm, and those blood cells are predominantly solid. Or even in, what are some other liquid parts? Sweat. There's solid parts within sweat. Even urine has trace elements in it. I'm not saying that the Buddhist texts actually have these trace elements in mind, but they're aware that within liquids there are solid aspects, solid components. And so that's what they are indicating when they speak about whatever else internally belonging to oneself is solid and solidified. these solid aspects, even of parts, organs, fluids, and so on, that are predominantly, that are liquid. Okay, now comes a very important sentence. This sentence establishes, okay, this sentence says, now both the internal earth element and the external earth element are simply earth element. That is, we don't think in terms of earth element, but we think this body is mine, I. We create this division. I am here, and what's outside is not me. And then the sense of I and mine gets attached to the body. But when one sees this body in terms of elements, and now one is viewing the body in terms of the earth element, then one sees externally what is outside is the external earth element. And then one sees, one understands the external earth element, the internal element, both have the characteristic of the earth element. They're both solid matter. Both have this property of hardness, solidity, resistance to spatial occupation. And so we take food, we have a plate of food. Now that's external matter. We eat it, chew it, swallow it, it comes into the stomach, it gets digested, metabolized, the nutrients get drained out, absorbed into the cells, assimilated, broken down, built. They get assimilated into the cells, utilized into the building up of the cells. Then they become part of me, part of the I. And then parts of the cells break off, get ejected. I cut my fingernails. Now the fingernail is me, I. But when the fingernail gets long, I cut the fingernail, cut them on a little slip of paper, roll up the piece of paper, and just throw it away. It's garbage, not me anymore. The cells get rubbed off the skin. Not me anymore. Cut the hair, shave. The hair, the whiskers, no longer me. Previously I, now not I. Because of this deeply ingrained habit, the sense of I and me is always focused on this here. And people become so maddened by the sense of I attaching to this that because of the color of the skin, because of the place, the country where this came out into the world, because of the maybe the shape of the eyes, because of shape of the nose, they're ready to kill and fight, destroy other lives. And yet, when one sees external earth element, internal earth element, it's all just earth element. And so, Venerable Sariputta says, actually this is, he's really quoting the Buddha here, that should be seen as it actually is with samapanyaya, with true wisdom, with proper wisdom, thus, this is not mine. This I am not. This is not myself. When one sees it thus as it actually is with proper wisdom, one becomes disenchanted with the earth element. This earth element in the body is just the earth element. One doesn't have any illusions about it being I, mine, myself. And then one's mind becomes dispassionate. It loses that attachment towards the earth element. Okay, maybe I'll just finish paragraph 7. Okay, this is another way to show the... Maybe I'll save that for next time. Otherwise, I might be trying to squeeze too much in. Okay, if there's any questions, then please feel welcome to ask. Yeah.
I know sometimes we talk about, conventionally speaking, you know, one of the disciples speaking in a conventional way. So it just seems, in the sentence in paragraph 6, it says, these things that are belonging to oneself should be seen with a wisdom, this is not mine. So, of course, these things, you know, think about the things that belong to yourself and then realize that they're not yours. So is that... And on the surface, it seems like a direct contradiction.
It's not really a contradiction.
Conventional speaking to say things that belong to oneself.
Pachatang. It's not really a contradiction, you see, because the Pali word here, okay, pachatang, it is based on the word atta, which means self. But the way that word is used, it doesn't imply the existence of a self, of a true self. You could say it's a conventional expression. We could say it's a conventional expression. But that word pachitta becomes so much a part of everyday usage that it wouldn't be taken to imply the existence of a self. It just means that there is, yeah, a conventional distinction between oneself and what is external to oneself. That is a valid distinction. But the distinction between oneself and what is external to oneself doesn't imply the existence of a truly existing substantial self. There's a kind of fluid line. Let us say it's a self with a porous membrane. Yes.
In other discussions of more primary elements, I've heard people compare it to in the different states, solid, liquid, and gas.
One would say that these... Matter, solid, liquid, gas, those are the states in which three of the four elements are predominant. In solid matter, the earth element is predominant, and the other three are recessive. In fluids, the liquid element is dominant, or the water element is dominant, and the others are recessive. In air, of course, the air element is dominant and the others are recessive.
It's really a different interpretation there. The fundamental thing is matter, there is a different state. And as you're describing it, the fundamental things are earth, water, fire, and air.
I'm not quite sure. What I'm saying is that in any specimen of matter, all four elements are present, but they're present in different degrees or with different strengths, so that one wouldn't say that this cup is, or this piece of chalk is solid, but one wouldn't say that this is only earth element, that there's no liquid element here, no fire element, no air element. In any piece or any type of material phenomena, all four elements are woven together. But if somebody compares the four elements or three of them to these three states, then that would mean that in the solid state, that is the earth element. So that means that there's no liquid element, no air element.
Yeah, I was just wondering if that analogy was capturing.
I'd say that that's only a rough analogy, but one can't take that to be an exact. One can't say that that is an explanation at the philosophical level of what's intended by the four elements. Somebody else have a question? No more questions? Yeah, please.
I was wondering if the Buddha actually touched upon the idea of a holographic presence in matter, and that represented, as part of the universe of matter. So that had come up in his thoughts or teachings.
Did the Buddha touch on a holographic presence in matter? I mean, I have a vague idea of the holographic, it's called the holographic paradigm. The idea that at the minute level would replicate what takes place at the macrocosmic level. I don't see the analysis of matter being pursued in that fine a detail. It's pretty much, analysis of matter is pretty much always kept at a practical level. And so this kind of theoretical analysis would not be undertaken. So I'm not saying that a holographic model is incompatible with the Buddha's teaching. It's just that one doesn't find it explicitly drawn out. At least I'm not aware of one. If somebody were to point it out, then who's more familiar with what's implied by a holographic model, perhaps I would see it. Okay, then, if there's no further questions, then we will conclude for this evening and then come back next week, starting with paragraph 7. I want to mention also, by the way, just that on November 7th, we won't have a class. Because that's election day, I have to give you an opportunity to go and vote that day, that evening. That is 3 weeks from tonight. I just mentioned that now. Okay, so we end by sharing the merits. Okay, we share the merits with the devas, the spirits, the other beings, asking them to rejoice in these merits and to help to protect the Dhamma, to protect the world, and to protect ourselves and others, and to fulfill all of their good wishes. akasata chabhumata devanaga mahitika punyantam anumoditva chirang rakantu sasanam akasata chabhumata devanaga mahitika punyantam anumoditva chirang rakantu desanam akasata chabhumata deva naga mahitika punyantam anumoditva chirang rakantu mam param etavata cha amhehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe deva anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya etavata cha amhehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe bhuta anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya